From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our discussion of violence on television. Yesterday, we discussed the pros and cons of congressional legislation intended to decrease the amount of violence on TV. Today, we'll talk to the creators of TV shows and movies about how they deal with the subject of violence and how they depict violence. We'll hear from David Milch, co-creator of NYPD Blue, Charles Dutton, the star of Rock, John McNaughton and Steve Jones, the creators of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and Walter Hill, director of The Warriors, 48 Hours, Streets of Fire, and Geronimo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has denied that he abused his office in dealing with allegations from members of his former security detail in Arkansas. Four state troopers have charged that he used them to cover up extramarital affairs. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
For the first time today, President Clinton himself was asked about the allegations. He declined to comment on the motivation of the troopers, who've admitted they are looking for a book contract to tell their story, or on the motivation of their lawyer, a longtime enemy of the Clintons.
I really don't have anything to add to what we've already said. I think the only things that I have tried to respond to today, and the only relevant questions, are the questions of whether I have abused my office, and the answer is no.
On another matter dogging the White House, the president said he would do what he could to cooperate in the investigation of the business dealings of James McDougal, a former real estate partner of the Clintons and the owner of a failed Arkansas SNL. Federal investigators have said they are looking for financial information about the real estate venture. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Paramount Communications says it has accepted a $10 billion merger bid from the television shopping network QVC. The agreement came after a recommendation from Paramount's board that favored the QVC bid over a lower offer from the Viacom cable company. The decision was a turnaround for Paramount, which had originally favored Viacom's bid and had to be forced by legal action to consider QVC's proposal. Paramount said that Viacom is still considering raising its offer. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says his economic reform program will continue, and Yegor Gaidar, the man responsible for implementing the reforms, will stay in office. From Moscow, the BBC's Robert Parsons has more.
Gaidar остается. Значит, остается курс, который он проводит. Вместе с президентом.
Gaidar stays, and that means the course of reforms he's conducting, together with the president and government, of course, also stays. That much, at least, was vintage Mr. Yeltsin. Brief, blunt, and to the point. Critics of Russia's reforms have said that the results of the elections meant that Mr. Gaidar, who's the architect of Russia's so-called economic shock therapy, would have to go. But Mr. Yeltsin left no room for doubt. Mr. Gaidar is to remain in the government. But the Russian leader sweetened his message with a suggestion that the government would amend its policies in light of the election results. The people had a right to expect more after 2 years of reform, he said. The government would have to balance the need to keep down inflation with the need to provide better social security benefits for the poor.
Robert Parsons in Moscow. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 17 points to close at 3,762. This is NPR News. Directors of the parent company of United Airlines have reportedly agreed to accept an employee buyout deal. The airline's union pilots and machinists offered more than $5 billion for a majority share in the airline. The Associated Press quoted a union source as saying that the directors of the UAL Corporation have approved the deal. Part of the employee proposal included a plan to create a discount airline within an airline that could compete against profitable no-frills carriers. The Justice Department has agreed to drop its antitrust case against the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The department accused the school of price-fixing by setting uniform financial aid rates with the Ivy League colleges. David Wright of member station WBUR has more.
The settlement clears the way for MIT and other elite universities to resume their practice of sharing some financial aid information in order to avoid bidding wars over the best and brightest students. Last year, a federal judge in Philadelphia ruled with the Justice Department that the practice constituted price fixing. That decision was overturned this fall on appeal. MIT's president, Charles Vest, announced the settlement today.
This brings to a close a very strange chapter in the history of American higher education. The complaint brought against us 3 years ago was ill-conceived.
The settlement bars MIT from telling other schools exactly how much aid it plans to offer a particular student, although schools will be allowed to share their best information on how much aid a given student may need. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
The nation's largest retail chain announced today that it will stop selling handguns at its stores next year. A spokesman for Walmart stores said the company will stop stocking handguns as of February. The company will continue to sell rifles and shotguns and will sell handguns through a catalog that will be available at the stores. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Is violence on TV leading to more violence in the streets? Today we're continuing our discussion about violence in entertainment media. Attorney General Janet Reno has given the TV industry the choice of cutting back on violence voluntarily or facing legislation that will force them to. There are currently 9 bills before Congress intended to decrease violence on TV, ranging from a ban on violent programs during the hours children watch to warnings that would flash in the corner of the screen during violent programs. Yesterday, we discussed the pros and cons of such legislation. Today, we're asking people who make TV programs and movies how they deal with the subject of violence and how graphically they depict violence. First, some thoughts from Senator Paul Simon, who has been spearheading the congressional campaign against TV violence. What has been the most compelling evidence to you that what we see on TV directly affects our behavior in terms of violence? You know, that violence on TV has a direct correlation to violence in our society.
Well, it is just all the research. It's a whole series of things that have happened in terms of research. We have over 2,000 studies now. We have at least 85 that would have to be considered very substantial studies. I don't think there is any question about that violence on the screen adds to violence in our society. There can be a question of the degree and how much that adds to violence. In a publication of research done by the American Medical Association in June of last year, it suggests that up to half the murders, assaults, and rapes in our society can be attributed to television violence. I think most researchers would not go that far. So there is disagreement on the degree of the harm. There is no disagreement on the harm.
Do you feel that violence is ever a cathartic experience and an experience, the kind of catharsis that we look to art to provide us?
Well, I think that those who argue on that side, and there are some who have argued on that side, the research is overwhelming that that is not accurate.
Senator Paul Simon, perhaps the most talked-about new TV show this season is NYPD Blue about New York City cops. It's been acclaimed for its writing and acting. But some viewers have been offended by scenes with partial nudity, street language, and violence. David Milch co-created the program with Stephen Bochco and wrote the first few episodes. Milch is former executive producer of Hill Street Blues. We wanted to talk with him about the dramatic use of violence in a gritty cop show. First, I asked him if he thinks of his show as violent.
Sure, we show violence. Violence is a daily fact in police work, and so I would not dispute that ours is a violent show. Is it excessively violent? I think absolutely not. Is it gratuitously violent? No. When we show violence, it is part of the fabric and texture of the lives of the people that we treat with every week, and it's legitimate. We show the real consequences of violence, and to me, that's responsible dramaturgy. It's no different from telling any other kind of story. The violence that I object to, and which I would hope Attorney General Reno and Senator Simon and the others are referring to, or what I would prefer they would refer to as violence, which is mechanical, and the recourse of bankrupt imaginations who are just looking to jolt the viewer or to get an ending before a commercial. I think that violence is irresponsible.
Do you think that kind of violence should be regulated, but your kind of violence shouldn't?
No, I don't think any. I don't think it should be regulated. I think it should be deplored, and I don't think it helps anybody, including the viewer. But it's a separate question as to whether government, that paragon of effectiveness in other areas, ought to be the instrument for quelling it.
What are your concerns about how your work will be affected if there's either any form of self-regulation within the industry or if the government steps in to do something?
Well, if there's self-regulation within the industry, I would assume that the parameters would be ones that we could live with. I would do the show exactly the way we're doing the show.
Have the kind of standards changed since you were working on Hill Street Blues? Is there a difference between what you feel comfortable doing now and what you did then?
Particularly as it applies to violence, no.
Yeah.
Because we've never, neither on Hill Street nor on NYPD Blue, is violence an essential? I mean, we just don't have that much of it, and when we do it, we try and do it responsibly and effectively. And to the extent it's effective, I mean, it's not very pretty, and it isn't something that you just show a lot of. It just isn't a part of a mix that would be effective if there were too much of it. We have an episode coming up in mid-January where a cop who is an important character is shot down in the street, and I mean, and we show that. But in terms of the guidelines or what we can or can't do, that has never changed since I've been in the business.
Attorney General Janet Reno has said she hopes that someday public service announcements will be superfluous because the programs themselves will be delivering those messages. And there's also something called the Harvard Hollywood Initiative from the Harvard School of Public Health. This is an initiative to encourage writers to incorporate socially responsible themes in their scripts, such as like the designated driver idea. Do you welcome that kind of idea, or do you find it confining, you know, to think of people suggesting that you put in certain good role model type themes into your work?
Yeah, I welcome the information that is provided by those sorts of public interest groups, and I read it. And then, to the extent that, the short answer is no. I would never tell a story, you know, about a designated driver. Or that's not what we're doing any more than, you don't want to rent the show out as a soapbox for moral improvement or anything else. But I certainly think those are all admirable goals. I mean, I think if you're stiff, have somebody else drive, but I'm not going to, you know, do a three-part series about it.
Well, I think of NYPD Blue as a character show. The characters are cops, and the violence that's in it really isn't graphic violence as much as it is incidents that reveal things about their character and about life in urban America.
Well, I should be interviewing you. That's what I think, too.
The two shows that I know that you've worked on, Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue, are both cop shows.
Yeah.
Why are shows about cops, about people who are professionally involved with the criminal part of the world, why are those particularly interesting to write? And what do you need? What do you need on your palette to be able to do the kind of show you want to be able to do?
Well, I've done other shows too, but you're right. The shorthand in, among network programmers is that cop shows have a natural element of jeopardy, and as by jeopardy that means high stakes and danger, and that that's attractive to a viewer. Having said that, you know, it was 8 years between cop shows for me, and we wanted to do, as you put it very well a little bit ago, we wanted to do adult stories about people who happen to be cops, and particularly cops in New York, because we felt it was the occasion for addressing some very complicated and rewarding themes about the relations between cops and citizens and the relations between races and so on. And to put that sort of, to accommodate those sorts of themes in a context where other more accessible responses to situations which might be violent or sexual were also present. I mean, that, as you say, that makes for a full palette.
Are there scenes that you've had to fight for, that you've had to go into a network executive's office and say, we really need this scene? I know you want to take it out, but we need this scene.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with the history of our show, but we didn't get on the air for 2 years because there was so much back and forth with the network about what could and couldn't be shown. So that by the time we actually started to film, a lot of those questions had been answered. Nevertheless, there have been, I would say, maybe a half dozen scenes in the first 13 episodes. We're now on doing our 16th episode, where the network raised its hand or asked us to do it a different way. And there's some give and take there, but we had come to a pretty full understanding before the cameras rolled on those questions.
Now, are you feeling the heat from this controversy on violence on television? Do you feel that you're being asked to tone things down?
No, absolutely not. And as I say, we would not. That's
what, you'd pull the show rather than tone it down?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we did. We, you know, that was what those 2 years were about, was we wanted to do the show in a particular way. And this is not to have the privilege to show people gunned down in the street. It's our sense that the conventions which the show now obeys allow us to do a kind of realistic story which we would be prevented from doing otherwise. That is, that... And again, that has to do with addressing certain themes. It isn't a question of being able to show a buttock or the like. It's a whole package. And if you begin to concede in one area, then you're I think that the whole fabric begins to unravel.
David Milch is the co-creator of NYPD Blue. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with our discussion on television and violence. My next guest, Charles Dutton, is the star of the show Rock. Rock is a comedy about a working-class African-American family, but the show often tackles serious issues that such a family would face. Dutton wanted to do an episode that carried a strong anti-violence message, especially to young people. The Gun episode, which airs early next year, is about a teenage friend of the family named Terrence. Gang members have humiliated him twice. On the third encounter, when they tell him they want his jacket, after having already taken his sneakers, he pulls a gun. He thinks it's the only way he can get them to leave him alone. Later that day, he tells Rock, played by my guest Charles Dutton, and Rock is furious.
Do you know what you're getting yourself into here?
All I know is that Damon is always picking on me. And when I flashed my piece, he was afraid of me for the first time. It felt good.
Oh, it felt good, huh? Well, let me tell you something, Terrence. I'm gonna give you the straight up truth about carrying a gun. Once you have it, and you flash it, and you see the fear in the other guy's eyes, I mean, that taste of power can seem very sweet, but it can't last because the answer to a gun is a bigger gun. And this guy Damon's gonna be coming after you. Does he run around with a gang?
Sort of.
Sort of? Well, now his gang is your problem, too.
What am I supposed to do?
Well, you gotta give up the jacket. It ain't worth dying for. I mean, what's going on with you kids is insane.
At the end of this episode, Rock is in a classroom lecturing to the kids against violence. I asked him if he thought the end was perhaps too preachy.
I don't think it was preaching to anyone. There's enough buffoon clown shows on the air. Martin Lawrence show number one and every other black show except for Rock as far as I'm concerned. There's enough of that on the air that people say, oh, that's fine. This was a way to use this powerful media to simply make a plea to parents and the young people on the insanity of all this. Now, okay, it's one episode, and it's one show, and it's one time that they'll see it. But you compare that with the amount of garbage that they see, the amount of violence that they see on television, it is worse, if you want to call it sermonizing or preaching or hitting them over the head with it. I feel it's worth it.
Yeah, well, let me stop you there. You seem very angry in this episode, and it seems to be an anger that goes a little beyond acting the part. You seem genuinely angry as Charles Dutton, not just as Rock. And I'm wondering if there are things that you've seen recently in your own life that have brought this issue home.
There isn't a day that that doesn't go by when I'm not affected by what's going on, whether it's out here, whether it's in the East Coast. I mean, I've lost many friends to violence in one form or another. There was an incident. I was in Baltimore early in the month of November to basically bury my brother who passed away, and there was a 10-year-old kid in Baltimore who was just playing football on the street, and then some drug dealers drove by and was shooting at each other and hit a 10-year-old kid. A couple of days later, a 13-year-old kid was killed. And a couple of days later, a 17-year-old kid was killed by some other kids who just came in with AK-47s. And sprayed the entire house. And then a couple of days after that, a 72-year-old grandmother who some kids shot because they were looking for her grandson. And she was trying to explain that the grandson wasn't there, so they said, well, just kill her. 72 years old. So, and all this in a matter of, 8 to 10 days.
You know, that Senator Paul Simon has given the TV industry a deadline of January 1st to come up with some kind of way to decrease the violence on TV or face legislation that will force them to do it. Are your colleagues in the industry talking about this debate over violence in television now?
Well, sure. Lots of people are talking about it,
What have the conversations been about? What have they been like?
Well, I think basically, a lot of people are saying, well, it's not television, it's society at large, and then a lot of people are for it, but then you have the economic question, you know what I mean? Jurassic Park was violent, It made millions of dollars. So, what kind of violence you have? I think people are still, in a way, confused or unprepared, basically, to deal with this thing. If it's because you have a musical element as well now that's glorifying drive-bys and gangsters and all this. It's a way that this country has always had a romance with outlaws and gangsters and those outside of the mainstream. Television has a responsibility to everyone, but in particularly where African Americans are concerned, I'm a little less concerned about the amount of violence, and I'm more concerned about the images of African Americans that television continues to perpetrate and what I consider negative images.
Just about everybody has something that aggravates them about television, whether they think it's too much violence or that the programs are just too stupid or that people are portrayed only as stereotypes. But just about everybody is dissatisfied. Now, you're trying to do a show that's different, that is a comedy that deals with real people and important messages. Is there anything standing in your way of doing that? You know, because everybody always complains, but then it seems like everybody's helpless to change it.
Sure.
So are there commercial pressures or any other pressures on you that make it difficult to do what you want to do with Rock?
I don't really... It's interesting you should say that. That's a good question. We're on a network, basically, that I fight with every week, you know, because you should fight. I mean, I think it's healthy to fight for your vision. But in the end, I am allowed to do what I want to do. It's just the fighting to do it that can be very frustrating and anxiety filled.
What do you fight about? What are some of the issues that you've fought about?
You fight about images, basically. You know, you fight about.
Can you give me an example?
Well, okay, but this show, for example.
The show Terrence Scott Is Gone.
They didn't want to do a gun show. If you say AIDS or if you say guns, the automatic response or reaction from a network is, no, it's not funny. It's not going to be funny. How can you make that funny? You know? And it's just a question of, you know, you compromise. You know, you say, well, I wanted to do one on abortion. They said that was too hot to handle. So, you know, I compromised that one and said, well, teenage pregnancy. Well, we're still up in the air on teenage pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what effect I'm going to have in the long run. But I do know that as long as I'm on the air, I would rather have an epitaph for a show that you could put opposite All in the Family, that you could put opposite the other great shows that have been on the air, and say, well, you know, they in the three seasons that they were on the air, or however long it was on the air, you know, that the show did well, and the show tried to say something, and the show, and we didn't demean and mock and buffoon ourselves, you know, because there's been enough of that for 40 years.
Charles Dutton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'd like to thank you for listening, Terry.
Charles Dutton is the star of Rock. The show's anti-gun episode airs January 4th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on violence and the media in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you're making a movie about a violent person or a violent culture, how do you show that violence on screen? How far do you go? Coming up, we talk with John McNaughton and Steve Jones. Their first film, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, was given an X for its disturbing moral tone. The film ended up on many critics' 10 best lists. We'll also talk to veteran action film director Walter Hill, whose movies include The Warriors, 48 Hours, Streets of Fire, The Long Riders, and now Geronimo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. An historic day in South Africa. The all-white parliament voted itself out of existence, approving the new South African constitution. Under the document, South African blacks will be equal to whites for the first time in the nation's history. They will also have the right to vote and hold political office for the first time. President F.W. de Klerk says he is more convinced than ever that he made the right decision in launching reforms which led to the new constitution. The Pentagon is sending out detailed regulations on how to implement the president's new policy on gays in the military. It prohibits the military from asking new recruits about their sexuality and forbids military personnel from saying they are homosexual. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
The policy attempts to distinguish between homosexual conduct and homosexual status. A service member will not be discharged for status or orientation. Only homosexual conduct, which is defined as an act or statement that demonstrates a propensity or intent to engage in homosexual acts, or a homosexual marriage, can get you thrown out of the service. Pentagon General Counsel Jamie Gorelick says there must be credible information that homosexual conduct occurred.
Credible information is not rumor, it is not suspicion, it's not opinion. It's facts.
Gorelick says activities like going to a gay parade or reading a gay magazine in and of themselves are not credible information to start an investigation. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Arab gunmen shot and killed two Israelis in the West Bank today. Israel believes the fundamentalist group Hamas is responsible for the attack. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The two Israelis were from the ultra-Orthodox town of B'nai Brak near Tel Aviv and were returning from a store that sells ritual objects in a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. 10 miles north of Jerusalem, their car came under a hail of bullets from a car traveling in the opposite direction. PLO leader Yasser Arafat said that the attack shows that time is not working in favor of either side and that the peace process must be implemented to end the violence. In Tunis, he told the Secretary General of Israel's ruling Labor Party that when he comes to the West Bank, he will work to lessen the influence of Hamas and end the violence. Hundreds of angry Israelis demonstrated in Jerusalem after the incident, and opposition leaders presented no confidence motions in the government. Jewish settlers held an emergency meeting to decide on their reaction as Israeli soldiers braced for more violence. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 17 points today to close at 3762.19. Trading was heavy. 267 million shares changed hands. This is NPR News in Washington. Directors of United Airlines' parent company have approved a $5 billion plan to allow employees to buy the airline. The deal would give United employees a 53% stake in United in return for wage and benefit concessions. What could be the final shot in the battle over Paramount Communications? QVC Network Incorporated Chairman Barry Diller today signed a $10 billion merger deal with Paramount. That move effectively ends a takeover bid by Viacom, which had offered only $9.6 billion. Viacom is free to raise its bid, but has not yet done so. Millions of Americans with slightly elevated blood pressure levels that had been thought safe may face a greater risk of health problems than previously thought. That according to a study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
The study focuses on people with a moderately high systolic blood pressure. That's the first of the two numbers given in a blood pressure reading. Doctors have traditionally believed that the second number, the diastolic pressure, is the important indicator of who's at risk for heart attack and stroke. But scientists with the Framingham Heart Study found that even a slightly elevated systolic blood pressure, a reading between 140 and 160, can be dangerous. One in five elderly Americans may fit this category. Dr. Daniel Levy headed the research team.
These individuals were at a greater than twofold risk for developing cardiovascular disease compared to people with optimal blood pressure.
Levy says people in this borderline group should consider altering their diets and exercising to bring their blood pressure into a safer range. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
A winter storm guarantees a white Christmas for parts of the southeast. Parts of Tennessee and North Carolina report 16 inches of snow. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today we're continuing our discussion about violence in the media. In this half hour, we'll talk with filmmakers who became controversial because of the violence in their work. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is a movie loosely based on the life of serial killer Henry Lee Lucas. The film was bold, realistic, and in some scenes, graphic. It ended up on many critics' 10 best lists. My guests are the film's director, John McNaughton, and producer Steve Jones, who also collaborated on Mad Dog and Glory, which starred Robert De Niro and Bill Murray. It's possible that the TV industry will soon have a rating system for violence, similar to the rating system that movies have now. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, was given an X by the Motion Picture Association of America. Usually, when a film is rated X, the director is given the chance to edit out the problem areas. But McNaughton says that's not what happened with Henry.
Our film was probably the only case where they didn't give us an option to say this scene, they did basically said the overall moral tone of this film is just, you know, wrong. They didn't say wrong, but they said the problem is the overall moral tone. We have no idea how you could change this film. There is no way to change this film.
What did that mean to you, that the film had a disturbing moral tone?
That was actually a source of pride.
Right. I mean, that was the point, you know? So...
The point was that you were making a movie about somebody who was disturbing morally. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that their point was that we didn't provide a moral point of view for the audience. You know, we didn't take them through a sort of this is right and this is. We just sort of presented a picture of these people sort of for perhaps 2 weeks. Without moralizing and letting, you know, sort of throwing it into the audience's lap and saying, what are your moral, you know, I mean, feel around inside and see what you can come up with. What do you feel about this situation? Rather than say, okay, you know, we didn't introduce the police. They weren't, Henry was not captured at the end. He was still assumed that he was out there. And it was like, now think about all this stuff. And there's people like this out there. It was to provoke and not to preach our particular morality on the subject.
We also had suggestions from, I think it was from British press, that in Britain the biggest problem they had was with Henry and Otis watching a video replay of the crime they'd committed, the home invasion.
Because they videotape the crime themselves, and then they play it back later.
Exactly. They videotape a home invasion, and then they sit down and watch it later on as entertainment. And apparently the British censors felt that we were including the audience in that voyeurism, which is actually true. And they had a very big problem with that.
Yeah, what were you trying to say with that scene?
Trying to implicate both ourselves as filmmakers and the audience into the idea. You know, the scene was sort of set up in a tricky way where you see this family being killed, and you see it through the video viewfinder, so you make the assumption you're seeing it as it's happening. But at the end of the scene, you realize that the camera, the movie camera, has been trained on the TV screen in their living room, and what you're watching is not the act in progress, but the video replay back home while they're sitting on the couch, you know. And it's the idea of being entertained by violence.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time the camera pulls back and you realize you're not seeing as it occurs, but you're sitting sort of visually made to feel as if you're sitting on the couch with Henry and Otis watching along with them this, you know, horrendous slaughter of a family. And I think that's the key moment in the film where you sort of have to turn your gaze inside yourself, and if there's a time for moralizing, I think certainly that's it. Moral exploration of your own self, if you will.
Well, you haven't made another movie like Henry, right? I mean, the other movie you made that I've seen is Mad Dog and Glory, which is a wonderful offbeat comedy.
But even that has its moment of incredible violence. But
yeah, I mean, the beginning of the film is in black and white, and it's a scary, violent scene. And then the whole tone changes as soon as that scene is over. It's like an homage to your first film.
But I think in some ways even that is another example. And by then I don't want to say we didn't know what we were doing when we made Henry, but in Henry we were just literally trying to get a movie made. When we made Mad Dog, we sort of considered the idea of responsible violence, and rather than glorify it or glamorize it, we tried to make it as realistic as possible so that you immediately knew what kind of a world these people were living in. And we didn't have to ever refer to it again because, we set it up at the very beginning of the picture.
And also, in order when we were researching the picture, Mad Dog and Glory, because De Niro plays what's known as a crime scenes cop, myself and Steve and, of course, Richard Price, who sort of initiated the whole idea and spent time with the New York police, and De Niro would spend time with these crime scenes cops in both New York and Chicago. And, you know, they just only respond to homicide and go out and document the evidence, take photographs and stuff. So we would actually, you know, spend evenings in their offices and wait for the phone to ring, which meant someone was murdered, and go out to these crime scenes and see the actual, you know, victims and see how the crimes were investigated and work with the people who did the work and then see their books, because they photograph all the homicides. You see, and this sort of endless variation of you know, methods people use to slaughter each other that happens. I don't know what Chicago, I don't know what the average is. In New York, I remember one statistic: in the last 7 years, there were 2 days without homicide. So, you know, supposedly the arts are supposed to be a mirror to reflect the society. I mean, violence is so prevalent, it's hard to avoid the subject.
But, you know, without comparing our own work to high art, there are paintings through history that are insanely violent. I mean, paintings in the Louvre of, you know, all the saints being
Goya, Bruegel, Bosch.
All those fellows, you know, they show these horrific scenes of people being burned and shot full of arrows and having their hearts ripped out or their heads chopped off. And that's something that is prevalent throughout history. It's one of it's part of art form, just as much as something of non-violent things and things that make you feel whatever emotion, love or beauty or hope. There's also despair and fear and, the revulsion to violence. Each of those is a color of the palette of an artist. And I think it would be hard to say, well, these particular emotions or events are unacceptable, whereas these others are, and you can portray them all you like, we'll leave you alone. I think it sort of reduces the emotional content of art to chop the dark colors out.
My guests are the director and producer of Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, John McNaughton, and Steve Jones. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with the makers of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. There's some pressure, I believe, on the television industry now to put out more programs with positive messages, anti-violence messages, messages against date rape, messages for designated drivers, and so on. I wonder if you have any concerns. I mean, Janet Reno has said that she hopes one day public service announcements will become virtually superfluous because the television programs themselves will have taken on the responsibility for those messages. I wonder if that raises any concerns to you, and if you're worried about the place that the dark
impulses will
have. The audience
will stay away in droves, and that will be the end of that, is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes to be preached to.
there wouldn't be very much left to, there won't be very many stories left if you remove all of the less than honorable attributes of, you know, human behavior. I mean, it just, they just won't be interesting. If everybody is a good guy and only performs well and always makes the right moral choice, there's not going to be drama anymore.
Steve, let me ask you, as producer, when you go to see a studio executive or, you know, a backer with money, what are the things they want to know about Henry? And
as possible.
Uh-huh. Like, what kind of reaction do you get from them about that? And do they... Yeah.
The thing they want to talk about the most generally is how we only made it for $100,000, and it, you know, its return was so incredibly large compared to the initial investment. I think that more than anything, that's what they talk about. And we generally, when we walk into studio executives' offices, they tell us that they are the biggest fans of the film because it's the kind of film they can't make. It's not commercial.
So it hasn't stigmatized you in the industry?
No, not at all.
No, I don't think so.
Very little stigmatizes you in that industry. I think except it's... stealing small. They frown on that. And getting caught.
I think it still doesn't hurt in that industry to be considered an artist. It doesn't necessarily mean they'll hire you, but they will look up to you for artistic achievement.
Have you ever seen a film that you thought went too far?
I don't really know what too far is exactly. It's hard to... I've seen films that were so incredibly bad that I thought that they
too
went
far.
Too far.
Badness.
But I don't think as far as... I mean, there's a film called The Killers by John Woo where it's a ballet of violence. And at the end of it, you're sort of laughing hysterically. And once again, I don't think you're saying, gee, I want to go out and do this on my block. But on the other hand... if you sat there and looked at it rationally, you'd go, this guy went way too far, which is sort of the joy of it.
Can you think of any films that you've seen that were very violent, but that reached you, that really spoke to you, that you thought were wonderful films?
The Wild Bunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Say something about why.
Well, I mean, it's very much a man film. It's about that sort of camaraderie and you know, these type of characters that their West was dying and their sort of code of honor that they had amongst themselves, you know, and they went out in a blaze of glory. But I just thought it's sort of a tremendous picture.
I also thought that for its time, Bonnie and Clyde, which was when they upped the level of graphic violence, it was something that hadn't been seen before. The Wild Bunch is a good example as well. And that initially had impact on everyone saying, well, gee, now I can actually feel this violence a little more. And maybe it's not people shooting guns at each other with no repercussions. There's no blood. There's, you know, the person falls down the end. Menace to Society was something that really came out and grabbed me. More than anything, the kid who's shot and is sort of twitching in the street, there's no way a sane person could look at that and say, gee, this is really swell. You know, this is showing you what the effect of violence is on a human body as opposed to, you know, the cartoonish violence that you see in many pictures.
John McNaughton and Steve Jones collaborated on Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer and Mad Dog and Glory. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, I understand you were at the White House today where you interviewed the president.
That's right, Terry. Mara and I talked to the president today. It's a kind of a conversation about the end of the year, things he's thought about, things he's learned, things he wants to do as he heads into the coming year. He talks a little bit about the situation in Arkansas, but as you probably know from listening to the news today, what he mainly says is that he doesn't want to talk about that. We also have a report on India's energy crisis as its energy needs have increased, environmental degradation has increased, and we'll have a book on rising to the occasion, how to make a toast, for instance.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Walter Hill is a veteran action film director whose movies include The Warriors, 48 Hours, Streets of Fire, The Long Riders, Trespass, and now Geronimo. The Warriors landed him in the middle of the controversy over violence in film. This 1979 movie was about a street gang in New York fighting its way home through enemy turf. When the movie opened, there were two killings at theaters featuring the film. Many people assumed the movie inspired the violence, but Hill says one was a case of a jilted boyfriend. The other killing involved people who hadn't even seen the film. I asked Hill if he thought there was any connection between his movie and the deaths.
I think that that night, that there was clearly a sad set of coincidences. I think that after the notion had been planted in everybody's mind that there were some fistfights and et cetera within certain theaters that maybe had to do with people attending the movie. I mean, but again, I think that it really had to, it had to do with people when they run into each other. Various gangs didn't like each other to begin with. They happened to run into each other in the theater. And
so do you think this has to do with the fact that movies about gangs tend to attract some gang members to the movies?
Well, yes. I think that's subsequently been shown. There have been many incidents on almost any film that had to do with gangs. And indeed now, I think it was it Godfather 3 that I think its opening night two people were killed, people running into each other. And
No, one argument would go that even if the movies on the screen aren't directly responsible for the violence that breaks out in the theater or outside the theater, that the climate that those films help to create, that the world that those films show, is such a violent world that it encourages people to act out their violent feelings in reality. And I wonder if you think that that's a plausible argument. Do you feel that violent films encourage people to be violent or excuse their violence in any way?
Well, I don't think there's, to my knowledge, and again, I'm not a social scientist, I don't think there's any compelling evidence to suggest that's true. But I think there's a much deeper philosophical argument,
mm-hmm.
and that is to say, let's say that it is true. Let's say that somebody does go see a movie and draws the wrong, is simple-minded enough to draw the wrong conclusion and goes out and does some terrible thing. Clearly, this person will be statistically a tiny, 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 tiny minority of your audience. And are you going to change an art form based upon one person and their irresponsible actions? I mean, what is really clear, I mean, the thing that is statistically clear is that masses and masses of people go to these things and conduct quite normal lives afterwards. That's the overwhelming statistical truth.
We're in a climate now where the film and TV industry are being pressured by Congress and by the Attorney General to curb violence or else submit to some kind of government or industry restrictions. What do you think of that?
Well, I think very little of it. I think that it's unclear that you're going to, if you disarm Clint Eastwood or Arnold Schwarzenegger, that it's going to make the world a safer or better place. I think that it's clear that we have a terrible crime problem in this country, and I'm certainly support anything that we can do about it, but I think limiting the artistic imagination is probably not going to have any effect short run or long run other than as a detriment to our culture. But I don't want to defend other people's taste. There's a lot of directors that do things that I think are in bad taste, but at the same time, I don't know how you legislate against that.
Well, I wonder if you've been thinking about censorship or self-censorship. Do you think that this fear of new regulations or a new code within the industry is leading towards self-censorship now?
Well, I think clearly what's going to happen is that...
And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Some people would argue that that's a good thing. It would mean that people are restraining themselves from putting in more violence than is healthy or decent?
Well, I think that it's, again, what the definition of healthy and decent is. One hopes that anybody that makes a living as an artist or in a certain creative way is always bound by a sense of the dramatically appropriate and good taste. But I just don't understand how you legislate that. And I think that when you think of the controversy surrounding, I mean, I suppose the Wild Bunch is the best example of this. Don't you really believe that the culture of the United States and indeed the world is better off because that film was made? And didn't it say a lot to a lot of people about certain issues that were very important in its time, I think remain important? And it would be it will be the first kind of movie. This I promise you. It will be the first kind of movie that doesn't get made with the government getting involved.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's going to be it's going to be, as I say, the first victim. It those kinds of film.
People, which kind of film?
Well, how do we define it? Okay, let me try to think of this. Films that show the savage and terrible consequences of violent acts, I think, are going to be in a boldly graphic manner, will be the first victim.
So films that you think are ultimately about morality in some way will end up being the first victim?
Yeah, I think, again, the Wild Bunch, The Deer Hunter, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the films that we're really talking about, if not absolutely legislating out, will be pressured out of existence.
But do you think that those films about the true consequences of violence would be suppressed sooner than the more comic book action films like RoboCop or Terminator?
Mm-hmm. They will, because they have a much slenderer financial base. I mean, they don't make money the way Terminator 2 or what was the other one you said? RoboCop. They're just not on the same financial par, and therefore there won't be the same resistance among the financiers in regards to movies like The Wild Bunch or Deer Hunter.
Walter Hill, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Walter Hill's latest film is Geronimo. Our programs on violence in the media were produced by Amy Sallet, with Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, Phyllis Myers, Nancy Greenlease, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif is our intern. I'm Jerry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look ahead to Christmas with Karen Armstrong, author of the new book, A History of God, about the idea of God in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. She's a former nun who now describes herself as a freelance monotheist. Also in the Christmas spirit, shopping. We talk with the former CEO of Bloomingdale's, Marvin Traub. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.